on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Concurrent with my pagan path is this interest in crows, because like they're intelligent creatures. For me, they are a portal to worship and get in communion with Gaia, the earth goddess. Here is evidence that this goddess, earth spirit, whatever you want to call him, her, it, it's like these intelligent special birds who go, whose legacy goes all the way back to the cave paintings, and it lasts 20,000 years ago, that this, they're like emissaries.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Rick DeAmpert to discuss his book, Crows and Ravens, Mystery, Myth, and Magic of Sacred Corvids. Rick discusses the intelligence of crows and ravens, crow language, how they show up in myth, religion, and prophecy, crow magic, and how a corvid just might have been depicted in the Paleolithic cave art of Lascaux. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Rick DeAmpert is a Florida resident and longtime journalist who spent 23 years as the arts and entertainment writer for the Daytona Beach News Journal. He presents workshops and performs on sitar and Native American flutes at pagan festivals in the Southeast. He also presents lectures on metaphysical topics at non-pagan events and venues, including Unitarian Universalist churches. Rick has studied Hindu sacred sound, shamanic drumming, goddess worship, Taoism, and more. His crow art has been displayed at galleries and art festivals around Florida. He joins me today to discuss his book, Crows and Ravens, Mystery, Myth, and Magic of Sacred Corvids. Rick, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you for having me, Nick. Looking forward to this. It's always a good day to talk about crows.
Yes, yeah. So I really enjoyed your book. I really like crows and ravens. And I was curious, though, when did your interest in crows and ravens begin?
It wasn't totally an Oprah aha moment, but you know, I kind of asked myself that later, and it really happened in 1995. I took my first trip to Ireland. I've only been twice, but my heritage is Irish and French, and I knew some about Irish mythology. And at the General Post Office in Dublin is a statue of Cuchulainn, who's the ancient mythical Irish warrior, and there's a statue of him dying. It's a pretty famous statue in Ireland, and he actually had tied, it's a bronze statue, and he's slumped, he's tied on a post, he tied himself around a post because he wanted to die standing up, and on his shoulder is a crow or raven, and different scholars debate whether it's a crow or raven. And I just, when I saw that in person, it's like, what is that crow doing there? What's up with that? And I just kind of knew the basic myth, and that kind of set me off on like, okay. And then finding out that, oh, the crow or raven actually is the Irish battle goddess, the Morgan, in shape-shifted crow form. And at the same time, I was about 2 or 3 years into my pagan path, my pagan spiritual path. So those things kind of conflated there. It's like, okay, what's up with the crows? And then back home in Florida, crows come to my backyard all the time. So yeah, it was the Cuchulainn statue in the heart of Dublin. So, yeah.
So that led you to start investigating crow, the symbolism, the mythology?
Evolution. It was over the years, probably around 2008, 2010. I'm on my back patio, right? This is my home office. I like being outdoors in nature. So at my other place, which I used to live 3 miles up the road, there were woods behind me. There's woods behind me here. So I've been blessed that a lot of crows come into my backyard. And so just watching them sometimes through my patio, sometimes through my living room window. Anytime I was working at the newspaper for a while, but when I was doing writing at home, and then when I went into freelance writing, I set my laptop up so I can see the woods. And so crows daily coming in. And then even before I knew the biology of them and all that, it's like, these are not your typical birds. And just through just naturalist observation, not that I have any special insight, it's like, what's going on? So just over the years, and then I started giving them names, because I would notice there was one crow that was considerably larger than the others, but not excessively. And I named him Lord Valiant, because he seemed to be the alpha crow. And there were like five or six crows that would come daily. And people would ask me now, how do you tell the difference between crows? They all look alike. They pretty much do. Sometimes the males tend to be slightly larger, but that's not a definitive way to tell between female and male. But the way you distinguish crows is their behaviors. They have, if you watch them, there's been crows here. One spring, there were two crows that I named Boga and Baka. They would get the crackers that I put out, and they would fly. It's like, where are they flying? And then one day I went out, and they would take their crackers to my roof. And that's where they would eat. Other crows would go to different trees. So just over the years, watching out my back window and patio, it's like, oh. And then the weird shit started happening. I looked out one time, and this is in the book, and I was like, is that crow hanging upside down on the tree? And I was like, what? And I scrambled to get my camera. And by the time I got my camera, it was gone. It was probably about 10 yards. My backyard, then there was a line of trees. Then there was a man-made but natural-looking canal. And then there's woods beyond that. And so after that, I said, I literally questioned myself. Did I imagine that? Did I see? And it was only years later when I read in a crow book that some other corvid files, corvids is the family or genus name. There have been other reports. People have seen crows hanging upside down on trees. And I'm like, okay, I didn't imagine that. And with my interest in tarot, I immediately thought of the hanged man in the tarot deck with the man hanging up. So that happened. Another time I looked out in the backyard. This was in my old place. So it was 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. There were like 20 crows on the backyard just chattering, ka 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 ka. I call it a crow ruckus. And then I saw one crow was on its back on the ground. And the others were not attacking it, but they were what's called scolding it. And they were... I still don't know what was going on, but there were like 20 crows around. They were surrounding this one crow. It was on its back in a defensive position. And I'm like, what the freak's going on? And again, that this was an exhibition of their unusual behavior. That lasted about 5 minutes or so. And then they finally flew away. And the crow that was must have done some bad shit or something. He got up and flew, or it could have been a she. And so those kind of things kept happening. Another time I'm watching a crow in the backyard, one of the slash pines, and suddenly it just shot up. I was like, wow, it looked like a rocket taking off. I'm like, what's going on? And I didn't think anything about it. And then about 5 minutes later, I looked in the backyard, and there was an alligator in my backyard from the canal. So all these kept happening over the years, and I would do some research. Then I started taking photos of the crows, and through digital woo-woo, I don't use Photoshop, but I would take photos and what's I don't know if you want to call it filters or whatever. I would kind of make them into psychedelic whatever, and print them on canvas and post them on Facebook. And at the time, I was also working as the pop culture writer for The Wild Hunt, the pagan news website. And so my editor there, Heather Green, and she ended up leaving The Wild Hunt and became an editor at Llewellyn. And she saw one of my crow images that I'd posted on my Facebook page. And she said, "Rick, why don't you write a book about crows?" I said, "Okay, I'm interested." So that's how that came about. And then once it was definite that the book was going to happen, that's when I started doing a deep dive into all the biology and the mythology. I was picking it up sporadically just because they're fascinating creatures. But that's when I really started. Wow. And the deeper I got, the more I wrote this book for myself as much as anybody else, because it helped me to really formulate and get a clear perspective. And all this dovetailed with my pagan path. So in the early 90s, I came across an image of Cernunnos, the ancient antlered god of the Celts, in a book that resonated with me. It's like, who created that thousands of years ago? Why did they put antlers on a man sitting in a Buddha pose? And as you may know, or your listeners may know, there's not a lot of historical record, but it's like I connected with that Cernunnos, so that set me on my pagan path. And I just had always resonated, you know, I tell friends, it's like, yeah, I'd go out in the woods and I would have this kind of ooh feeling. And you know, some friends would jokingly say, "So that's your religion? You go out in the woods and you have a funny feeling, and that's what you base your spiritual path on?" Well, kind of, sort of. And then crows, and there's no ravens in Florida from everything I've read. They don't exist. So if I keep saying crows, it's because I literally don't see ravens in Florida. They may have invaded the state, because a few times ravens are really larger than crows. And they have thick neck feathers, and crows do the traditional caw, and ravens don't do that. They have what's been described as a gronk or a quonk kind of sound. So concurrent with my pagan path is this interest in crows, because like, they're intelligent creatures. For me, they are a portal to worship and get in communion with Gaia, the earth goddess. Here is evidence that this goddess, earth spirit, whatever you want to call it, him, her, it, it's like these intelligent special birds whose legacy goes all the way back to the cave paintings and it lasts 20,000 years ago, that they're like emissaries to me. And I'm not alone in feeling that. And they show up in my backyard every day. So here comes the goddess. Anyway, I'm going to be quiet and let you.
Well, no, that's okay. There's a lot that you've touched on that I wanted to chat about anyway.
Sure,
so sure. We're going to maybe go back and then kind of proceed forward a little bit.
Sure,
but one of the quotes I did have in front of me from your book was that they offer portals into directly experiencing the sacredness of nature and open us into deeper relationship with Gaia. And I think that observing the natural world in this instance, crows and ravens, does give us that special connection, because I think so often we just move through the world and we don't pay attention. But it's when you really start observing, you know, other citizens of nature, that we start feeling that deep, profound connection.
I honestly can't remember if this is in my crow book, but I know it's been in my other pagan writing. I almost think the heart of modern pagan practice is awareness. Is being aware of the rhythms. There's a pagan writer, a blogger, Stephen, and I should remember his name. I think his last name, P-O-R-S-C-H. Anyway, I loved his blog. I haven't read it in a while. He lives in Minneapolis. But one time he just wrote a short piece that said something like, do you know what time the sun rose today? Do you know what time the sun set? Do you know when the next full moon is? And it was kind of, it wasn't really a snarky tone, but his point was, his readers are pagans and Wiccans and practitioners of witchcraft. His point was, how much are you or we as a earth-based spirituality, how in tune are we actually with what we say that we are worship or that we feel communion with? And so I think what you say is very important, just to have or to cultivate or to seek out this awareness of life, nature, processes. And crows are a very striking example of that. It's also in my book, you know, we hear about it, how intelligent apes and monkeys are, and dolphins. And I think elephants and octopi are starting, I see articles about them. But we don't, most people don't have any interaction. If you're in Africa, you might run into gorillas or whatever. If you live on a coast, you may be able to spy dolphins. But we don't have access to have communion with those animals. Crows and ravens, we do. They're right here. And so that's why when I use that word portal, I mean it literally, kind of, and metaphorically. If you have your eyes open, and you don't even have to live near woods. I see more crows when I go to the Target shopping center, except in my, you know, in my own backyard, they come every day. But every time I go to the shopping center, they're up on the lamppost. They're waiting for somebody to drop a French fry. If they just, you know, they'll swoop in. They're scavengers. They're wise. They're what I call human gregarious. Crows more than ravens. So they're very cautious, but they're comfortable around urban population. And So yeah, they're an opportunity for this communion. Even if you don't do like I do, if you don't do crow related rituals or practices or tarot readings, just if you open your eyes, you're going to say, wow, this is fascinating that these intelligent creatures are here.
Right. Yeah. Let's spend just a little bit of time talking about their intelligence. I think at one point you described them as feathered apes.
That's a phrase from John Marsluf, Marzluf. He is a biologist, wildlife biologist. Last I read or heard, he was at the University of Washington. And he and his partner, Tony Angel, I say partner, he gets co-writing credit. But John Marsluf is the crow guy. He's written two wonderful books. And in my book, I recommend that anybody read his books. But that's his phrase. That's his phrase. He said, they're feathered apes. And I thought, man, this guy, Dr. Marsluf, what a great PR guy, because he realizes in modern day, short attention spans, how do you grab somebody's attention? If you say crows are intelligent, people go, oh, okay. But if you say they're feathered apes, people go, what the freak? Yeah. So that's his phrase. And it's very true. Everything I've read, he's done so many studies, in the lab studies, there's photos of him putting an anesthetized crow under an MRI to study their brain patterns, that kind of thing. So when we say that crows are feathered apes, it's not just colloquial anecdotal, it's got scientific evidence to back it up. And he's not the only one doing that, but he's like the main guy. For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are signs that there is intelligence in nature. that we often assume, and I always disagree with this because we say that humans are the most intelligent. I'm like, we have our own kind of intelligence, but other species have their own intelligence. And I know that I've read about crows and some of the research that they can count. And I forget how high they can count to, but that they can count. They give gifts. You describe how they remember faces.
And again, that goes back, that's an experiment that John Marsliff did on the campus, I believe it's the University of Washington. He and his colleagues, students, researchers, they would literally, they came up with some kind of contraption to trap crows. It was some kind of trigger device, and it would throw a net. And believe me, he's not harming crows because he's the last one in the universe. But he would study them and then release them. And then he and some of his colleagues noticed that when they walked across the campus, the crows would be like dive bombing them. And it was like, what? What's going on? And they wouldn't be dive bombing other humans in the vicinity. Well, he finally figured out, it's like, all right, they seem to be alerting on me, not humans. And so he did this experiment. It's pretty famous in crow circles, and I'm summarizing it here. But he literally had some of his students, and him, I don't think he, himself, I don't know. Anyway, they put on a, I believe it was a Dick Cheney mask. Remember our vice president?
Oh, yeah.
And then they would do, they had a, I don't know if it was an actual crow corpse or a mock corpse. If it was an actual crow corpse, they didn't kill it. It was one that they came about natural. But anyway, the crows would alert when they would see a human near a dead crow. And then, so they put the mask on and had whoever was wearing the mask walk across campus with what appeared to be a dead crow. And the crows would go apeshit, like, wah, caw, caw, you know, warning. And then they would have the same person just walk across campus, no crow carcass, no Dick Cheney mask. The crows did nothing. But if anybody put on the Dick Cheney mask, the crows would go apeshit. And it's like, oh, they remembered from a week ago when Dick Cheney was carrying a dead crow. So they were alerting, but it even became further expanded because they figured out that it wasn't just the two or three crows that had seen Dick Cheney. It was other crows on the other part of campus. It was more than just three crows. So somehow they had communicated to their fellow crows that this particular human is bad, will harm crows. So they were able to communicate to others. And so they remembered anytime the Dick Cheney mask came out, they remembered that face. It's like, bad man, very bad man. And there's more nuance to the study he did, but that's the gist of it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, now we know they do indeed. And they communicate that to others. So very important for any crow people, if you're going to, you know, cultivate a communion, you got to be careful to not do something stupid. You say, oh, okay, I didn't mean to do or whatever. They will remember, and then they'll tell the rest of their immediate tribe, and you'll be on their shit list. Seriously. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm thinking that maybe they had just read the newspapers about Dick Cheney and came to know that
well,
he was a bad man that way.
I would not be surprised. Like, there probably is a photo of a crow reading a newspaper.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, well, you know, there's often, you know, front pages flitter about in the wind and whatnot.
There you
so,
go.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So the crows know, man, the crows know. I think it's also interesting that in your observations, you have, I guess, distinguished perhaps something of a crow language.
Well, I have, and again, hopefully this is stating the obvious. It's not, I didn't come up with this. I'm just, I have experienced what other researchers and both scientific and mythological that they're, we think of crows as caw, caw. It's like, oh, that's if you're writing a novel or in a Hollywood movie, if you need a crow, the crow is going to be going caw, caw, classic sound. They have a, what to me is an immense vocabulary. They, back in my old place, I don't know, five or 7 years ago, however long ago, I stepped out in the backyard and I heard a cat. There's slash pines, my yard, and then there's a just a line of brush and forest, then the canal, then the woods. Anyway, in the slash pine way up high, I heard a cat meowing. I was like, oh man, it sounds like that cat is stuck up there. Because, seen in the movies or whatever, cats climb up high and then they're scared to climb down and the fire department come. Like, oh man, that's kind of distressing. What? Anyway, after about 10 minutes, I saw it was a crow. It was a crow kind of making this caterwaul cat sound, kind of, and it's very cat-like. I was like, holy cow, holy crow. And I it's first time, and now I hear it, just about every day. There was, they make a dove-like sound. One day, which I did not hear until my new place, I heard kind of that murmuring purr. It's not purr, but kind of the murmur of a mourning dove. Ooh, ooh. I thought, oh, there's a dove in the woods behind my home. It's a crow. They make a clicky clack sound. And all this has turned up in the mythologies of the past, especially there's an ancient Irish text. It's actually a text of prophecy. And there's an ancient Tibetan text. And when I say ancient, 500, 600, 800 years old, it's in my book. But these ancients in Tibet, and I don't know if it was called Tibet 800 years ago, but somebody back then made kind of a, in the Irish culture and in this Tibetan culture, they kind of made a list where they associated certain crow sounds as well as behaviors in a prophecy sense. So if you heard a crow say three, and they had their own, three, they came up with their own onomatopoeia, however they rendered it in writing. If you hear three calls by this crow, it means the king is coming to your village, literally. If you see a crow to the west and the crow makes this kook-kook sound, then that means that one of your farm animals is going to die. And then the ancient Irish had kind of something similar. But back to your point, these were all based because these ancient cultures noticed this vast vocabulary among crows. And myself here, there's a certain caw, caw, that they typically do in the morning. And I think it's, I it either means A, come here, because they come by every day. Anytime I hear a crow, I go throw some crackers or tortilla chips. That's, I train them to train me. So I let them train me. So they know if they caw, here comes this guy with food. So, and in that process, usually when, if there's just one here, I'm 99% sure that when they caw, they're calling their others to come. Oh, the guy with the crackers is back. And sure enough, 2 minutes later, four or five or six will come. So they're definitely communicating. And so do other animals, dogs, cats, or whatever. But this is much more sophisticated. And so I've kind of, over the years, I've been trying to match up their sounds with the behaviors or what's going on. And they certainly alert on hawks or other threats of danger. And even when they say ka, there's different emphases, just like us humans. You know, you can say no, meaning no, I'm not going to do that. Or you can say no, or no, you know. Yeah. And they have those different inflections. So it's, I don't know, to me, it's very fascinating. And it's something that I think us humans, we can actually kind of learn. Now, whether, I'm not saying I have a conversation with the bird,
right,
but you can kind of say, okay, this is, they're communicating ideas and situations is probably a better term.
Right.
So,
yeah. Yeah. I used to hike a canyon when I lived in Southern California. I hiked a canyon every week on Fridays, and I called it my Friday office. And I would see, I couldn't tell if it was a crow or a raven. And I'll ask you about the difference here in a moment, but sure. I think it was probably more of a crow. But I would only see them typically when I would head into one campground area. And it would make sense that, you know, if you had campers there, they may be picking up, you know, bits of food. But the times that I saw them, they would swoop down kind of in front of me, sort of cawing. And every time there would be a rattlesnake nearby. So I started thinking, ah, they're warning me about snakes.
I think that's very, very probable. I mentioned earlier about the crow that
literally right.
took off. And I thought, that's such a strange, I'd never seen that. And then the alligator was out there. But yes, to your point, I very probably think that is the case. There's, in crow circles, I say famous, there was a naturalist, Lawrence, L-O-R-E-N-Z, and now I forgot his last name. And I think this is mentioned in my book. But he was a naturalist and an animal behaviorist, and not just a friend of crows and ravens, but he tells an incident. He lived in the Northeast. This is back in the 50s. And the way he writes it, he says that this raven spoke his name. Mm-hmm. And he had somehow developed a relationship with this raven, would see it. And he was walking in the woods one day, and it may have been a snake. Anyway, he said the raven communicated to him in English and that there was some danger on the path ahead. And I was like, wow. So, but I very much think that could be the case, because even the crows that, you know, that come here, and there's about anywhere from 6 to 9 that come by daily. They're still skittish around me. Just only in the past 2 months have I noticed 2 or 3 of them. When I go out, they'll stay on branches that are like 10 to 12 feet from me. But if I get too close, they'll go higher up. And I don't discount all these YouTube clips where, you know, you mentioned crows bringing gifts to people who have been showing them kindness. I've had friends who said, oh, growing up, we had a pet crow. It was wild, but it would come by, it would hop on my shoulder. And I'm like, envy, man, I would love that. Not discounting those kind of scenarios at all, but I don't think they're as common as people may assume, because you can see them on YouTube and they're fascinating. I love watching them. You know, when somebody posts, oh, here's a crow, there's a video of a crow messing with somebody's cat, not messing, but the cat's here and the crow's here on their balcony, and their crow's going gah, and the cat's going meow, gah, you know, and it's like they're just sitting there bitching at each other. So I don't discount those, but I think that kind of thing doesn't happen as much as our modern digital life would lead us to.
Yeah. So before we move on to some of the mystery, the myth, and the magic, let me ask one final kind of biological question here in terms of the difference between crows and ravens.
There are differences, and I put this in the book. If whether you're a pagan looking to, you know, form a communion with them, or whether you're just an amateur naturalist or birder, the first thing would be to look up to see the range of crows and ravens. And crows have a bigger range in the U.S. So that will help you. So again, that's why anytime I see one of those birds here, I just automatically rule out that it's a raven, because Audubon and other bird websites say ravens aren't in Florida. So there's really three main differences. Ravens are considerably larger, like 20% larger. And unless you have them side by side, it's going to be kind of hard to say. But I had an interesting conversation with a neighbor of mine a few months back who's not a pagan, but he knows I'm writing a book on crows. And he went out west. And when he came back, we talked on my daily sunset walk. I passed by his house. And he said, "Rick, I see what you mean about ravens," because I forgot where he went. I don't know. It's Arizona, Colorado. He said, "I saw these black birds," and he said, "they were way larger than the black birds I see here." He said, "I knew that I was seeing a raven, because here's a guy that doesn't have a special interest, but when he saw a raven, he was like, whoa,
yeah,
okay, they're considerably larger." And if you see them in flight, ravens, their tail feathers are kind of more pointy, like a spade or a shovel. And so ravens are going to kind of be like that, their tail feathers, and crows are more smooth and rounded. And then, but the easiest way is their speech, their talk.
Yeah.
Crows, and there's YouTube clips that will show you this. And once you hear that, you're like, oh, yeah, it's not like it's a little bit of difference. It's a considerable difference of how they articulate sound. So that size, the noises they make, and the tail feathers. And I guess one other important distinction is everything I've read, ravens are more people shy. Not exclusively, because there's plenty of accounts. Bernd Heinrich has written several books on ravens. There's plenty of people that have relationships with ravens, but it's just less common. Crows are like, oh, humans, cool. Ravens are kind of like, I don't know about those humans. I'm going to kind of stay away a while.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I think of ravens, I often think of specific places. So, for example, the Tower of London. And also New Mexico, Chaco Canyon, they have ravens there.
In all my years in New Mexico, I never went to Chaco Canyon, and I want to go. My girlfriend, Michelle, she grew up in Utah. I spent my early childhood in New Mexico, so we're planning a trip back there, and that's one of the must-sees.
Yeah.
And I want to see a raven. As far as I know, I don't think I've seen a raven, because I've spent most of my recent decades of life here in Florida. And you mentioned the Tower of London.
Yeah.
Boy, it was so freaking disappointing. I read this and it was incredible. You know, you as a journalist background, I always preface a lot of observations with, I got this from a credible source. So I got this from a credible source that the ravens at the Tower of London, you may have heard of the myth that as long as the ravens are there, England will be protected or favored by the gods or King Arthur.
Right.
But if the ravens ever fly away, that means England's going to be in deep shit doo-doo. You may know this, but I read somewhere not too long ago, they clipped the ravens' fucking wings. So they can't fly away. It's like, man, that really upset me and pissed me off.
Yeah.
Like, if the ravens want to go, let them go. But
yeah.
I assume that's true. And obviously the birds can still live, but it's like, we're going to hedge our bets and clip their wings, which makes them unable to fly. Okay, so there's your myth for you. There's humans. See how we F with nature? We can't just let it be. Anyway.
Well, yeah, and it's not only is it horrible to the raven, but it also eradicates a possible oracle. You know, and the other thing that jumped into my mind is that, well, they probably did that right before
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about sort of the myth and the mystery and the magic now. And one of the things that run through several of the chapters of the book, and you've already mentioned it in our discussion here, is from the cave paintings at Lascaux. And there's one in particular. It's usually referred to as the Dead Man. But I know that scholars aren't always in agreement about whether or not it's dead. And from my education, it's not a dead man at all. And you address this, the interpretation that I'm most familiar with is that it is a sort of shamanic figure of sorts that may be in a kind of a trance. Now, you make the case, and again, you're kind of citing others here, that because in the image for anyone, actually, I should let you describe the image for the audience for anyone who is not familiar with it.
Sure. And I'm glad that in my book there is a reproduction, just simple line drawing of that cave art. Most prominent is a figure that is lying on its back, a stick figure, and it looks like a human body. And it's what's called ichthyphallic, which means it has an erection and it has a bird head. And then near that is a staff, and the figure is on its back, so it's either most likely dead or in a trance. And then beside it is a staff that looks like it's standing up, and it's got a bird at the top of this staff. And then over not too far from that is a bison that everybody agrees that the entrails of this bison are spilling out of its gut. So it's like it's at the moment when a hunter has injured it for the kill to eat the meat. So that raises a lot of possibilities. Shamanic trance, hunting accident, homage to the bounty of the earth. But why does this human figure, why does it have an erection? And why does it have a bird's head? It's a therianthrope, if I'm pronouncing that correct. It's a human animal hybrid. And to me, one of the most, and I'm not the, well, I don't know. I'm sure I'm not the first to notice this, but I didn't really read a lot about this. What's intriguing to me is that this human with the bird head and that bird on the staff look like they were drawn by a kindergarten. They're very simplistic and crude. And yet all these other, including the bison, are those beautiful ancient cave paintings of animals that look like a Picasso or a Van Gogh. And yet the human bird figure and the bird on the staff look primitive. I mean, literally primitive and just crude. So it looks like I've never read that it's two different artists, but that discrepancy, the animals are very beautiful, and this bird figure just looks like a child's drawing from today. So scholars, I mean, as you say, Nick, scholars don't agree what's going on here. The reason I mentioned John Marsliff, he thinks it's a crow. And the reason I think it's a crow is from everything that I've read about ancient ornithology, crows and ravens certainly existed. I think this painting goes back to 20,000 years ago, 18,000, they're not exactly sure, but crows and ravens certainly existed. And there would have been reason for the ancients to have painted a crow or raven because, like the ancient Norse and the ancient Celts, they would have noticed that these birds are different than others. It's not that the bird head and the bird on the staff, it's not that they don't look like crows, but you cannot say definitively that's a crow, that's a raven. But you can tell it's not an ostrich. You can tell it's not a cardinal. It's not a heron. I mean, you can rule out some of those other possibilities. But they would have had reason to incorporate corvid into that work. I mean, because obviously, whatever, even if they were just depicting hunting scenes for the ancients, and of course, I'm speculating here, just to be able to capture that in a painting or engraving on a stone wall, that would have been an act of magic in itself. I mean, who was that first human that created the first painting? That just blows my mind. Somebody back then said or internalized, like, I'm going to take this slice of life and cast it deep in this cave wall. I'm going to represent it. That was a huge leap, huge leap in human evolution in my mind. And I don't know that those cave paintings, they are the earliest in human, you know, they're all around the world.
Right.
Go to Bradshaw. I don't know if it's Bradshaw.com or Bradshaw Foundation. If you Google Bradshaw Foundation, what a marvelous website on cave art.
Yeah.
It's definitive, exhaustive. And so what's going on with this scene? I'm like you. I think it's some kind of shamanic trance. And the fact that it's a human-animal hybrid, that at the very basic, that tells me that the ancients felt in communion with the animal world, and in this case, birds, and in this case, very likely crows or ravens.
Right.
And the nature of that, well, we don't know, but it must have been special.
Right.
It must have been special. So.
Yeah. I don't know. I know that there's cave art that goes way, way, way back in both Australia and Africa, I think.
Yeah.
I think in Europe, one of the earliest that we have right now is Chauvet Cave, which dates back to, I think, like 30,000 or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way I learned the kind of to the interpretation of that dead man being not a dead man, but being kind of a shaman, is that one of the techniques or primary techniques of the shaman is going into that trance state. And so shamans around the world are associated with birds, and that maybe that's what the bird mask represented. And maybe that was, you know, the bird staff. And as you were speaking, the other thing, and I don't know if I'm right about this, but what came into mind was the TV show Game of Thrones, with the figure of Bran, who was kind of shamanic. And I think that Bran went into a raven in his ecstatic states, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's it. Yeah. And I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan. And now I'm trying to remember all this, you know, all the details of Bran and the raven connection. And I think I should know this, but is Bran maybe that's Welsh for raven or crow? And I don't think that was in the Game of Thrones universe, but I'm trying to think now. I remember, anyway, I guess I shouldn't get off on that tangent. But I think it's like you said, I think from what I've read with other cultures, the tales involving shamans involves shape-shifting into birds, and to visit the other worlds or the other realm. And there's that whole body of myths about birds carrying messages, especially corvids, ravens and crows, carrying messages to and from the gods to humans. So this is all, and that's something that's kind of fascinating. This is not a, you know, an original observation, but just all these threads of these different myths, how they intertwine, and how the Native American myths will echo portions of the Celtic myths, or, you know, you mentioned all the different sites of cave art So obviously it wasn't just the ancient culture in France or Europe, because there's cave art in Australia and Southeast Asia. And it's fascinating to me how these same motifs seem to surface in various ways. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think often it comes from just basic human experience and observation and, you know, the things that we've done, you know, in human evolution. And so I find it really intriguing that that may be Raven or Crow in Lascaux. And I know that we can't go into all of them because time is limited and we want people to read your book. Ravens and crows do appear quite frequently in myths around the world. And so I've got some of them noted, and maybe we can talk about the Native Americans in terms of totems and tricksters, but also, you know, the Celtic. But in some of our oldest written stories, they're in Gilgamesh and Noah. And I think a lot of people don't actually think about that, that, you know, it's there in the biblical text.
That was mind blowing for me, because I didn't know until like I said earlier, so I started doing a deep dive into, you know, researching. But yeah, Gilgamesh, I can't remember now if it's crows or ravens or both.
It was a raven, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's universally agreed upon that is the oldest. I don't know if you can hear the visitors here. Yeah, the crows. I'll give you some food in a little while. But yeah, that's our oldest written text. And I guess text should be plural, because it wasn't one single text. It kind of survived in different fragments written at different times. But there's our friend, the corvid. But I was really stunned to find the ancient Hebrew text with raven, crows and raven. And I guess it's in the standard edition of the Old Testament, or it's mentioned in there somewhere, that the first bird sent out from Noah's Ark was not the dove, but it was a raven, and it didn't come back. But there's these ancient Hebrew texts that are not part of the Old Testament that, and this is in the book, but the raven and Noah get into it because Noah is bossing the animals around and says, "Raven, go see if you can find land." And Raven says, and this is a paraphrase, but just kinda. And Raven says, "You just want to get me off the boat so you can have sex with my wife." I'm like, what? This is in this old rabbinic text. And it is not a leap to make right. that interpretation. And then Noah curses the bird. He says, you foul bird, to accuse me of that such lascivious behavior. I'm like, what's going on here? I mean, it almost seems like a South Park episode or something. Here it is in this ancient rabbinical Hebrew text. And again, it's a recognition all those years ago that ravens had, and crows, that they had a special noticeable intelligence. And so it's no wonder that even back then, cultures around the world began to sense and believe that these birds have a metaphysical, supernatural connection to the other realm, because they were, whatever led this creator of this text, you know, whether he had a dream that about Raven and Noah, or whether he was just telling a fanciful tale, it's very interesting that he chose a raven to be this character. But it's because they realized these birds, are they emissaries? Are they carrying messengers from the divine? Whatever it is, they are standing out. And frankly, it seems like the world, the ancient cultures, our ancestors lived in a more magical world. Mm-hmm. You know, I, this is a tangent, but I keep running across this, and I've seen this in my own grandchildren. You know, the old old saying, or anyway, that young people have a connection, can see spirits and talk to the deceased. And then people say, but then they're told, oh, no, you're not talking to your grandfather. You're imagining it. And so our modern culture at a very young age tends to drum out that aspect. It's like, no, you didn't see this or that. You don't see the spirit of your grandfather or ancestors. You're just making it up in your mind. But 100 or 1,000 years ago or whatever, there wasn't this modernism that was drumming that out of people. When those things happened, people paid attention. It's like, oh, you think the raven is somehow displaying intelligence? Those ideas probably got a better hearing, you know, 1,000 years ago, 2,000, which is kind of why we have this pagan renaissance of the mid to late 20th century, is that there's some of us who are, you know, not to give us modern day pagans over credit, but we're paying attention to those things, and anybody can.
Well, and it's, you know, one of the things that I've come across in my studies, and this is formal academia, is traditional ecological knowledge that small scale societies will hold on to and have, which does look at, you know, their myths, the symbols and the signs. And scientists now are saying, well, maybe there's actually some truth to these things, you know, because we've forgotten to look, you know. And so now it's like, what can we find out if we just look again?
Exactly. And I wholeheartedly agree. And as I mentioned earlier, I think a large part of modern paganism is awareness, just being aware. And I use this example a lot. I grew up in Los Alamos in northern New Mexico, and 5 miles down, 3 miles north of the trailer park where my family lived is where they developed the atomic bomb, where Oppenheimer literally was developing the atomic bomb and his colleagues in World War II. 5 miles down the mountain is the Bandolier, which is a site where the ancient, they used to be called the Anasazi, which means ancestor of the enemy. And in Navajo, and the modern Pueblo people said, rightfully, they said, we don't want our ancestors to be called the ancient ancestors of the enemy. We don't want to be known by a Navajo word. So don't call us Anasazi, call us the ancient Pueblo people. So anyway, Bandolier is there. And my family used to go there when I was a kid. And I noticed even at a young age, it's like it's a cliff dwellings. It's canyons and cliff dwellings, and they literally lived in the caves. And I don't know how much they modified the cave, but I remember the tour guide saying, "The genius of that, however much they adapted or modified those cliff dwellings, in the summer, they're situated so that they don't get a lot of sunlight, so it's cooler, and yet in the winter." The alignments of the structures that they built and however they modified the caves or however the ones they chose, in the winter, they get more sunlight. So here is ancient AC and heating. By what did they do? They knew enough to align where they lived. In winter, you're going to need more sunlight to stay warm. And in the summer, you're going to want to stay in the shade. So they had that very basic knowledge, but here today, we humans is like, oh, we're so much more sophisticated than our ancient ancestors. It's like they had a lot of knowledge. They were close to the land, and they knew the ways of the land. And so many, you know, we're alienated from that knowledge. And I think another thing is, in modern times, we are lucky to allow, we can allow other people to possess our knowledge. If I get a stomach ache, you know, I go take Pepto-Bismol. 200 years ago, if you had a stomach ache, you hoped that there was a healer around that said, oh, if you chew on this plant over there, it's got a natural herbal whatever that will make your stomach. I don't have to know that anymore. It's in a freaking pill. So I think if you, that's just a microcosm of human civilization today. We keep getting alienated further and further from the land, from nature, from Gaia. And if we allow ourselves to go back there, we discover amazing things.
So, yeah, things that may very well help save us.
from ourselves.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things in terms of ravens and crows, and also the observation that we've been talking about, is that if anything, in terms of, and maybe this is more along the lines of folklore, the reputation that they have is that they are messengers of death.
Yeah, and again, that's rooted in actual science and biology, because it's in the ancient records, you know, texts from 600, 400, 800 or 1,000 years ago, the ancient battlefields and the ancient Norse writing filtered through Icelandic writings and the ancient Irish writings. They would notice that ravens and crows would swoop down on battlefields after a battle, and they're both omnivores, crows and ravens. They will literally eat corpses, human corpses. And, you know, and today, if you drop a slice of pizza, they'll pick that up and eat. They eat insects, bugs, fruit. But back then, they noticed that, wow, these birds are quick to swoop down on ancient battlefields because it's food. And that's documented by history. And so there was only a short leap to, it's like, whoa, these birds, if death is around, these birds seem to be around. So that's part of how that, just that general idea of corvids being connected to death, how that sprang up, which is, yeah, it's pretty creepy. I got to admit, but I have friends today, you say, oh, you're writing a book on crows. Ooh,
yeah.
They're creeped out by crows and ravens. And so it resonated down through the century. And right. I think there's other causes other than just the battlefield theme,
right.
But that's certainly a palpable phenomenon. And it's also been documented, and I hope I'm not pronouncing his name right, Berndt, Heinrich. He's written several books on ravens, and he calls ravens wolf birds because he documented and studied that in the American Northlands, Midwest, North Midwest, that ravens seem to have a special relationship with wolves. It's not so much that the ravens are following the wolves and waiting for the wolves to make a kill, and then so the ravens can swoop down after the wolves have fed and they get the leftovers. What's really fascinating and just mind-blowing is that, according to, if I understand the studies correctly, the ravens will somehow guide the wolves to where they can make a kill. So the ravens aren't just passive waiting for a carcass to show up. They are somehow communicating, or they have this symbiotic relationship with wolves. So it's like there's caribou 2 miles over this ridge, and somehow the wolves have learned, it's like, oh, if we follow the ravens, we're going to be able to feed. So it's like, wow. So again, there's more evidence of how that death aspect. And of course, then we have Poe's The Raven,
right,
which is kind of a creepy poem.
There was, I don't know if you've seen it, but there was a fairly recent Netflix series, The Fall of the House of Usher. And
I have not seen that. It's on my list.
Yeah, it's good. It's very good. I enjoyed it quite a bit. But Raven does appear quite a bit, and Raven is kind of connected to not a figure of death, but sort of a figure of death. I know that's a little bit vague, but yeah, that's how they approach it. You know, no talking ravens, you know.
Okay. Well, have you seen The Sandman, Netflix?
Yeah. It's been a while, yeah.
So that's the talking raven, his companion
Right.
in the
Yeah,
end.
that's right. And there's also, well, before we move on to another mythic raven, but the association with crows and ravens and death, you know, that they're, you know, maybe feeding on, you know, corpses from battles and whatnot. Is that where the term murder of crows comes from?
I should know that, and I don't, and I don't know.
Okay.
I sh that is a question. I guess with myself and myself and other Corvid files, it's not that I'm gonna get nasty to anybody that uses that term, but I just avoid it,
Right,
the
right.
murder of crows, because it's
Yeah.
just like, oh, that does them a disservice. Disservice, lay off them,
Yeah. Then there are
but
those people who think it sounds really cool.
well, that's true. It's true. It's like it's much cooler than saying, oh, a flock of crows. It's like a
Yeah.
murder. And I almost, now that you mention it, I wouldn't be surprised if the crows and ravens and if their PR person,
Yeah.
probably their PR bird, came up with
Yeah.
that and say, look, we want to be badass,
Yeah.
so let's give the humans reason to respect us, and we're going to
Right.
spread that we want to be called a murder of crows,
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
screw those humans. We're going to rule. We
Right.
dominate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. You ever seen the meme of like two crows or two ravens sitting on a bench and the underline it says attempted murder?
I love that. Yeah, that was great. I think a crow or raven came up with that,
Yeah.
and somehow was able to communicate that. But yeah, I love
Probably.
that. I love
Yeah,
that.
probably. So let's just touch on a couple of the myths because one, I think one of the more famous ones is of the Norse god Odin. And he had the two, was it crows or ravens for
They're
Odin?
raven. They're
Ravens,
generally
okay.
considered raven. Yeah, Hugin and Munin, if I'm pronouncing them
Okay,
correctly.
yeah, thought and memory. But that also brings to mind the whole concept of the crow. You saw the crow hanging upside down from the tree because Odin
I hadn't thought
sacrifices
about that.
himself.
Yeah, I thank you for that, because I hadn't thought about the famous myth of Odin hanging himself from Yggdrasil in order
Yeah.
to gain.
Yeah.
It was when I was, I have to say, when I was doing my deep dive in the Corvids, I was just very passingly familiar with Norse mythology. And the more I dived in, I don't consider my pagan path to be heathen or Ásatrú, if that's how it's pronounced. But the more I dived into it, the more kinship I really felt with Odin and the myths and the legends. But it occurred to me, and this is just, I kind of had a duh moment, but Hugin and Munin, if I'm pronouncing them correctly, how do they get their names? It was because the ancient Norse just noticed that these birds tended to display thought and memory. It's like, duh, it's very basic. Like, how did they come up with those names? Well, in watching these ravens over whatever decades or centuries, it became very apparent they think, they don't just, it's like in my backyard. I put out crackers. The squirrels will come and get them right away and then scramble up the trees. And the crows, even to this day, they light on the higher branches. One will caw to the other. They're cautious. They're cautious. The squirrels are just, it's not that they're braver or courageous. They're just not intelligent enough to sense that anything from a human could be dangerous. The crows know. So they're thinking. In fact, I kind of smiled when I read another book by, I forgot which woman had written a book on crows, but she said, they always seem to be thinking every time I see them. And I said, yes. So the ancient Norse, you know, there's evidence that the crows had this intelligence of, oh, you avoid this situation while you're hunting for food, and you can do this, and here's a way that you can get food or whatever. And then, obviously, to me, my mind, you know, I mentioned that famous experiment with the Dick Cheney mask. The ancient Norse noticed that crows seem to have memory. And that they remember, you know, whether maybe it's just like the crows behind my home, they have remembered to come every day. I mean, they're literally here every day. They don't roost here. They fly away and they come back four or five times a day, but they remember. And it's, you know, it's not that I have a mystical shamanic, let's go see the shaman Rick. No, it's, you know, it's a food thing, but they're smart enough to like, hey, we won't have to hunt for crackers. This guy's going to put us some crackers out. And the ancient Norse noticed that. And so they made their god be associated with a raven whose names translate as thought and memory. And there's that very famous passage in, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce the sayings of Odin, where he's lamenting. He's saying, I know one day I send the crows flying. I'm paraphrasing horribly here. But he's talking about Hugin and Munin, and he says, I fear one day they may not come back. I fear Thought may not come back, Hugin, but I fear even more that Munin, memory, may not come back. Like, what a, I mean, the first time I ever read that, it just got me right in the heart, because here is, way back in this ancient culture, this realization of our mortality. And this is their god. And even their god is saying, one day I will die and one day I will be forgotten. It's like, wow. That's just a very powerful four-line passage. And it really spoke to me. And it's communicated through the magic of ravens and their behavior. So that message, you know, if that message was divinely inspired, the messenger again is a raven, two ravens. So wow.
That's one of the reasons that I always kind of go back and forth with this idea of the pagan. I don't really identify myself as anything, but there are definitely paganistic aspects of my thought, and I think that it is a reawakening, a remembering of what we used to know from the natural world, and remembering that, relearning that. And it's interesting. You're the first person I've heard mention a pagan renaissance. We've got a lot of renaissances going on right now.
Well, and you, this term, the term pagan revival may be out there. More, especially when Gerald Gardner, you know, was writing in the, I guess, after World War II, the famous British father of modern Wicca, and Doreen Valiente, who certainly played a role. And, you know, and even when I was a journalist in the 1990s here in the, I'm in the Daytona Beach, Florida area, I got on my pagan path in the early 90s and started, it's like, oh, this connects with me. But I was quote unquote in the broom closet. I started wearing, you know, the snake and the pentacle earrings and all that at work. And sometimes at the newspaper office, they'd ask me. But anyway, my editors, I said, oh, I want to do a story on some local witches. And my editor said, oh, yeah, sure. I was the arts and entertainment writer, but I also did features. But anyway, long story short, every story I did in the 90s was had to have an aspect. I felt it was my call that witches are not Satanists, and that a lot of witches are, even back then that term, are in the broom closet, that a lot of practitioners of this faith spiritual path feel the need to keep it hidden. And I would write stories on pagan pride days. I profiled some local witches who had one of them ran a coven. And then 8 or 10 years later, you know, through the miracle of the internet, you know, all that social media, suddenly that did not have to be an aspect of right. stories anymore. So it really did feel like a revival or renaissance. But that was after, you know, there seemed to be an explosion, you know, Gerald Gardner, Doreen Valiente in the late 40s, 50s, and then in the late 60s, you know, you could start to find tarot decks, you know, in stores. And there was the Magical Child bookstore in New York City and other things. So there seemed to be, and again, this is not my original research, just from what I gleaned. And now, in fact, just talking with my girlfriend, Michelle, and some friends, I'm wondering if I go to there's pagan festivals here in Florida. They seem to be getting less and less attendance. They're wonderful events. They're face-to-face. I'm going to be scheduled to appear at one in March and lead workshops in Crows and Ravens. But I'm almost wondering if there's another generational shift happening where I'm 65. I'm wondering if the pagans, witches, and Wiccans get their community these days from witch talk, TikTok, podcasts, digital. Yeah. I think there may be less and less need or compulsion to go out in the woods, get naked, drum, dance, and commune, which I love, or even have a local coven. So I think there's another generational shift going on where, and I don't think it's necessarily bad, it's just different. Just different. Today's Wiccans and pagans, if you want to get community, you can do what we're doing right here. And you know, I'm old school. I love drumming. There's nothing like a fire and naked people dancing around and getting back to nature. So the point I'm getting to, there seems to be these mini renaissance just over the past 60 years, 80 years, in my view.
Yeah, this is a bit of a off topic from the Crows and Ravens books, but it's something that I'm deeply interested in. And so maybe the pagan aspect is another conversation at some other point we could have.
We can go wherever you want to, Nick.
Yeah. But what I think that right now we're seeing a monumental shift in religion in the United States, and the fastest growing community are people who identify as spiritual but not religious. And for me, I've been doing a lot of reading on this. I think partly is the reticence of identifying as pagan, because I always want to ask, well, what exactly does that mean? And I don't identify with Wicca. When I was much younger, I was associated with or hung out with some Wiccans and, you know, participated in some of their rituals and whatnot. And I still like ritual aspects, but I find it now that it's much more personalized, everything I do, whether or not I should be identified as pagan, I don't know. But it seems to me, and maybe it is generational, but that there is, I don't know. It seems like there might be a movement away from what would be deemed, you know, like the Gardnerian Wicca or what have you, to something a little bit different.
Well, and what you just said, that very much parallels my spiritual path. In the early 90s, I identified as Wiccan. And after about 2 or 3 years, unlike you, it's like I'm not really connecting. For me, and I'm not, this is just for me, but I didn't connect to what I saw as ceremony. And I'm not saying that there's not a place for that, but I started identifying as pagan. And basically, I've given UU talks on this, and like you hinted at or explained or said, pagan, nobody can really, it's probably got as many definitions as there are pagans. But when I've give a UU talk on this, and I've given it, for me, the three main currents are an earth-based, nature-oriented spirituality. We see divinity manifested in nature. To me, another key aspect is that we see the divinity as having a feminine as well as a masculine aspect, which is not to negate the non-binary aspect. So that's certainly in there. So God is not just has not just male genitalia. And then the third aspect is that magic exists and plays a role. And then, of course, magic is another term that has many definitions. And I almost think, kind of getting back to you, it's like, for me, using the word pagan, you know, as a journalist yourself and as a journalist, and anytime I've written stories, just even today, you know, usually I have 25 paragraphs at the most to convey a story, because they were always, you know, if you're writing magazine, you can go longer. So we kind of have to use shorthand. It's like, okay, pagan basically denotes non-monotheistic religion.
Right. Yeah.
So that's kind of the baseline that almost everybody can agree on. Are Hindus pagan? Hindus would say no. And I know some in the pagan community. I think over on Zelle, founder of the Church of All Worlds, on his Facebook page, he posted a beautiful, glorious graphic of all these different faiths. And then some people said, why do you have the Hindu Om in there? It wasn't meant to be just pagan, but it was all these interfaiths, but it was all the non-monotheistic religions.
Yeah.
And immediately there, it wasn't a rancorous debate or anything, but it just made people think, how do we define pagan? I identify with a lot of the Hindu path. I play sitar. I wear an Om earring. I believe, like the ancient Hindus, that sound is God, that in the beginning was the noise, as Mickey Hart, the drummer, says. Energy is vibration, sound, that's primal. But that's something else I touch upon in my book. I think that applies here, is when we talk about metaphysical or esoteric or spiritual terms or matters, language fails us. It fails us. We try to, you know, I guess the word is ineffable, that which cannot be expressed in words. And that's certainly true of metaphysical and spiritual things. We try, and we have to resort to metaphor a lot of time. And even some, I've been amazed to find some progressive Christian scholars and writers will say that, like, oh, we really need to speak of Godhead in terms of metaphor.
Right.
There's truth in metaphor as well as hard facts, maybe more truth. So, and I touch on that in the Crow because I think it's an important point. And I'm sure you've heard this, I'm not the originator of this, but Wicca, paganism, witchcraft, we're not a spirituality or a religion of the book.
Right.
We're a religion of experience. And so, and the common metaphor is, it's like, well, it's like sex. You can read about sex and you can kind of get an idea of it, but until you experience it, once you experience it, it's like, oh, okay. It's very difficult to describe. And the same with a spiritual path. I go out into the woods, I have a spiritual experience. What the freak does that mean? Oh, it's a beautiful day. Well, something happens that, and I sense a divine presence, sometimes more so than others, and it's hard to go beyond that. People say, oh, you're making it up in your mind. I don't care if I am. This is what I feel. Anyway, all right,
back. I always consider hiking my spiritual practice.
You know, and it was Alan Watts. I'm a big fan of Alan Watts, the, you know, the British born guy who distilled Asian wisdom for America, and when he lived in America, but he uses the term walking meditation. And that's me. It's my meditation time. Instead of sitting here in the lotus position, if I'm walking, I that's when I do my best thinking.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So I know that we're running out of time, but I do want to ask you one last question regarding the book. And that is, and we've been kind of circling around this a little bit, but it's in regards to the magic, the crow-raven magic. And I was wondering if you could maybe say a little bit about that, because it's a bit different than ceremonial magic.
Yeah. And for me, magic is born in communion. And communion means just having an association, a deep association and connection with. And other parts of magic for me, and I say this in the book. In fact, one of my editors said, "Rick, you say this too often in the book." But for me, I'm very much into, if I'm saying his name correctly, Mircea Eliade or Eliade, who wrote Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. That's a key text for me.
Right.
So I use the phrase, this is my phrase that I came up with. We alter, A-L-T-E-R, we alter our consciousness so that we can alter, A-L-T-A-R, our consciousness. When we alter our consciousness, whether it's through entheogens, hallucinogenic drugs, plant medicines, ritual, chanting, drumming, music, making, if we alter our consciousness, that takes us out of the mundane monkey mind, as the Buddhist calls it, and puts us in an altered state. And in those altered states, strange, mystical, magical things can happen. And for me, having this communion with crows and ravens is, again, to use that word, a portal to getting into those altered states and really altered perceptions. For me, that's a very key part of magic. Is I've seen this attributed to Wayne Dyer. I don't think it's original to him, but the old, it's kind of a new agey phrase. When you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And that's, you know, okay, that's kind of hippy dippy, woo woo. What is that? What the freak does that mean? But I think there's a lot of truth in it. It's like when I see crows and ravens now, I can't help but think about their magical legacy. You know, the ancient cave painting, Hujin, Munin, the Native American, their trickster raven. So they are magical creatures to me, whereas to most people, and they used to be, it's like, oh, they're just birds. But my perception changed. And so with that change of perception, magic comes in, comes into play. So I have in the book, one of the things I like to do is with tarot readings. If I'm out just, you know, on my back patio and the first crow I hear goes caw, caw, does three caws. If I'm going to do a tarot reading, I'll put every third card into the layout. So that's my way of connecting with the ravens. I have a scrying. This, I happen to have a, actually it's right over there, just a toy raven that I bought at Dollar Tree or something. I just bought it. It's like, oh, that's cool. It looks kind of realistic. And then one time I just said, I'm going to do some candle scrying with that. So I put a candle in front of the crow on the pedestal. So it was casting its shadow on the wall. And the candle is flickering. It's dark in the room. And I went into this with intention. It wasn't the first time I'd done candle scrying. But, man, here was a dime store crow image. And when it cast that shadow, it looked like it was alive and flying. And it through that, I was able to go into a deep trance and just have this communion with God, Goddess, Godhead. And I when I came out of it, I just thought, wow, what just happened? It wasn't a real crow or raven, but it was the image of, and building on my just my interest in crows and ravens, it was like something just happened and it was very real. And again, that was just, you know, maybe that's silly to use a little crow toy as a portal, but magic to me is where you find it. And I'll mention shape-shifting, and that was the most frustrating book part of the book, because the first time it happened to me where I felt that I was in the body of a crow and flying, I didn't intend it. It just happened. And it happened because at my old place, Lord Valiant the Crow, he was the alpha crow. Whenever those five or six crows would come by, he would always be the first one to swoop down from the tree and pick up food. And he would come the closest to the house. The others wouldn't come as close. He would come within 6 or 8 or 10 feet of my back patio. The others would stay further away. And then just one day, I don't even think he wasn't even in the vicinity, but I just had this sensation that I was Lord Valiant coming down off the tree. And I even found myself catching my breath, like when you ride a roller coaster. And then I was above the trees, and afterward I'm trying to analyze that rationally. What the hell just happened? And I dance around it in the book, because I can't really say if you do this or this or this, you will have this therianthropic, which means human animal, I think is the Latin term or scientific term. I can think you can create the conditions for that to happen. And what happens when that's happened to me, maybe 4 or 6 times in my life, what's the purpose of it? What magical purpose does it serve? I can't really say, except it offers me a perspective of nature and earth magic that I don't get any other way. And I wish there was a way to tell myself, here's how I can make that happen. And it just kind of seems to have happened, not by accident, but you kind of have to prepare for it and then wait for it to happen, and it may or may not, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But again, we're getting back to how do we talk about these things? And like you mentioned earlier, I've done a few spell work in my life, but not very frequently, and had a kind of amazing results. One time I'd broken up in a relationship, and my ex-girlfriend, she hadn't called in three weeks or so. And I said, I was in a local bookstore, and I just opened a book on spells, and I came across a summoning spell. So I just read it and said, okay, what the hell, I'll try it. Anyway, I did it, and she called 2 hours later. You know, we didn't get back together, which is great, actually. But so I've seen spell work, but yet I don't feel this urgency to practice it.
Right.
For me, it's all about forging this sense of communion. I created a crow raven banner, like the ancient Norse would carry one into battle. And if it was flapping wildly, they felt that portrayed success in battle. So I created, and there's a chapter in the book, I created my own crow banner, hang it out here. And I'm amused when the crows seem to notice it. Like, what are they thinking? And I actually consecrated it by putting it in a tree where they came, what I call my crow raven, crow spirit tree. So the crows have actually been on my crow banner. But again, just seeing it, I'm looking at it here, just flying in the breeze on my tree in my backyard. It's awareness. It's reminding me that I share this planet with these magical creatures that I'm trying to understand better, and they take me deeper into this relationship with God, Goddess, that I haven't defined definitively, but that's my spiritual path, trying to find deeper communion with God, Goddess. And here we are talking about crows.
Wonderful. Well, I really enjoyed the book. I've always liked Crows and Ravens. I know some people don't. And I had mentioned to you, I think in an initial email, that my friend that I live with for a while had a murder of crows that would follow her. She was feeding them peanuts when she would walk her dog. And so that's how it started. But apparently one of the neighbors stopped her because they had a child that had peanut allergies. And so I don't know why she didn't switch to sunflower seeds or corn or something, but she's got little images of crows and ravens all throughout the house. And I've got a raven hat that I got at Chaco Canyon.
What? You got a raven hat and you're not wearing it?
Yeah, no, I thought about it midway through. I'm like, ooh, I should have been wearing my raven ball cap. But anyway, the final questions for you are, what do you have coming up? What are you working on next?
In the big picture, I mean, I do have some book signings coming up here in Florida, you know, at some local metaphysical shops. I'm scheduled to present at the Phoenix Fire Pagan Guest Gathering in March, mid-March here in Central Florida. As far as writing projects, I'm actually working on, it's almost completed, and I think I'm actually going to self-publish it. But you may have seen these books. There's a guy named Gregory Saar. Anyway, he wrote a book called The Book of Questions. And they're kind of not metaphysical, they're kind of ethical dilemma kind of questions. It's like, oh, okay, you could be, if you were given $50,000, would you rather spend it to save a cat or feed a hungry child? You know, that kind of stuff. Anyway, I got the idea to do that book of questions for pagans, Wiccans, heathens. And it's just questions kind of take people deeper into their spirituality. Just, you know, what magical tools do you use? How did you get into your pagan path? You know, some of the standard questions that I used to ask when I interviewed pagans for the Wild Hunt. So I'm hoping to publish that soon. I'm just going to do that independently and put it up on Amazon. And I think it's helped me to write it. I'm a big believer in, and I put this in the book, to keep a crow journal. I think I use this in the book. Many years ago, I experimented with, and you may have heard of the movie Alter State or Isolation Tanks. I said, I'm going to try and just create my own isolated experience. So I cleaned out a closet in my home. This was back in the late 80s. Made it dark in there, and I couldn't hear anything. There was no sunlight, and I just sat in there and meditated. And for whatever reason, this vision of Jim Morrison of The Doors came in. And it was like, whoa, and there was fire involved. And it's like, what the freak just happened after I got out of it? And I remember that, but I didn't write anything about that. And I regret it to this day. I should have written something just, you know, within a day of that experience. Here's what was going on, more about the experience. Now it's kind of a mystery to my own mind. So I'm a big believer in keeping a magical journal. It doesn't have to be pages and pages. But you will forget even the most phenomenal experience. You know, I wish I'd written more down at the time about the crow hanging upside down.
Yeah.
So I'm a big believer in writing, and I'm getting off on a tangent. So the main goal is to just keep writing, whether it's for my own magical diary, the book of questions, but beyond that, and making music. I play sitar a lot. My girlfriend, Michelle, we do a music duo. She's on crystal bowl, tongue drums, bass. I'm on sitar, native flutes. Sound is sacred. That's another interview for another time. So anyway, but I hope that answers the question. And thank you. It's been a joy.
Yeah. Well, one last question is, where can people go to find out more about you and your work? You have a website?
Okay. Well, geez, my website is in transition, but it's rickdeampert.com. The spelling of it is RICKDE, D as in dog, letter E, Y as in yellow, AM as in Mary, P as in pop, ERT.com. I know that's a mouthful, but It's my first and last name with no spaces.com.
Okay.
And I'm in the midst of building a new website. To check out my crow art, go to Mr. Crow, M-I-S-T-E-R. Mr. is spelled out. MrCrowArt.com.
Okay.
And that is up and working. And you'll see examples of my crow. And for me, the crow art, it's a way of expressing the metaphysical and supernatural aspect of these creatures. So if you go to the site, you'll see different examples, and I take photos, I alter them, I print them on canvas, and they're available for sale, and they're hanging all around my home. But that's a part of my magical path, is expressing visually this communion that I have with these animals. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the final website is wanderingspiral.com. Wandering as in WANDERING, spiral, one word, .com.
Okay.
And that's the website of my girlfriend, Michelle, and I. That's our music website. You'll see some samples there. I have a solo version of me playing the Beatles song, Love You Too, and you'll see Michelle and I. So we're available for booking. Shameless self promotion.
Yeah. Right now. So. Yeah, wonderful. Well, I will put links for the three websites in the show notes in the video description, as well as for the book. My understanding, the book comes out in March, okay. I think. So yeah. This episode should be released right around that time.
Oh, cool.
We'll get that. So, well, Rick, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed speaking with you this morning. It was great fun.
Thank you so much. And if you're down in Florida, we'll go talk to the crows together.
All right. Okay.
All right, man. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. And that's a wrap on episode 121 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. I'd like to take this moment to thank my newest patron, Russ Davis. Your support is truly appreciated, Russ. It is with support like yours that I can continue with the podcast. So thank you. I am incredibly grateful and humbled by your generosity. If anyone else would like to be like Russ, and please be like Russ, and support me in my mission of exploring spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's relationship to a living earth, you too can sign up for my Patreon. Perks for patrons include early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, shout-outs to members, a members-only Facebook page, access to the Rebel Spirit Radio Discord server, and a monthly book club where we explore books discussed on the podcast, spiritual and philosophical classics, and books related to the cocktail apocalypse. You can find the link for my Patreon in the show notes or video description. If you'd prefer, you can still make a one-time donation via PayPal. I will be tremendously grateful for any support that you can provide. Another way that you can help the podcast is to share it on social media, share it with friends and family. That really is one of the best ways you can help and support the podcast. Help me grow my audience. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.